The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme, the life of an agricultural innovator, Harry Ferguson.
He developed a technology that was transformational, a disruptive technology, changed world agriculture.
How a farmer's son from County Down became a global industrial pioneer. Plus, the spacecraft sent to study Halley's Comet.
There was a hope that by studying what the comet was made of, they could find out what the solar system was made of.
We'll hear from astrophysicist Susan McKenna-Lawler, who worked on the European Space Agency's Giotto mission in 1986. But we begin this evening with a violent incident in South Donegal in 1920. During the War of Independence, violence sometimes unfolded through small, intensely local encounters among neighbours who subsequently continued to live side by side, however happily or unhappily. We're going to hear now how one such encounter connects a rural townland in South Donegal to a much wider political story, featuring in the family history of a major political figure. Our reporter is Mark McMenamin.
On the night of the 21st of August 1920, 14 IRA volunteers attacked the house of James Corscadden. Corscadden was a 61-year-old farmer. He was also very much a senior member of the local Carrignohorna Orange Lodge. He was also a Freemason, and he was an officer in the South Donegal Ulster Volunteer Force.
This is Edward Burke, assistant professor in the history of war since 1945 at University College Dublin. Dr. Burke is referring to an incident which took place in Carrignohorna, a small townland outside Ballyshannon in County Donegal at the height of the War of Independence.
Corscadden was targeted by the IRA because they believed that he had UVF weapons, which were of course craved by the IRA in the area, which were short of serviceable rifles and ammunition. So 14 IRA volunteers that night approached the farm. They had been tasked by a senior officer of the South Donegal IRA, Seamus Ward, to attack the farm. When they arrived, fire was opened on them by the inhabitants of the farmhouse. One volunteer John O'Donnell, later claimed that Ulster volunteers who were present, that they had planned an ambush, a counter-ambush on the IRA party, and so he described it as a stronghold of Ulster loyalism.
James Corscadden was targeted for an arms raid by the local IRA. The local UVF group was prepared for a counter-ambush, and in the ensuing melee, one of the IRA men, John O'Donnell from nearby Cashelard, was injured.
O'Donnell himself was shot. He was wounded in both legs. He was particularly grievously wounded in the right leg. He suffered a disability in his right leg for the rest of his life. And indeed, he received £20 compensation under the Army Pension Act. However, he never fully recovered the use of his right leg. You know, he had to carry the injury for the rest of his life.
According to Edward, somewhat typically in Donegal, loyalists and Republicans went on to live amicably side by side after the truce.
Unusually, or perhaps in Donegal, you know, more typically than some other parts of Ireland during the revolutionary period, both John O'Donnell and James Corscadden lived adjacent to each other in adjacent farms for the rest of their lives in South Donegal. So O'Donnell was from the townland of Cashelard, and his home abutted that of the Corscadden family. So both sort of continued to live in the area, and despite this violent episode in 1920 afterwards.
And the man targeted that night, James Corscadden, himself went on to have a very famous great-nephew, the future British Prime Minister, Tony Blair. Blair was hugely influenced by his ancestry in Donegal. He often visited his relatives in Rosnaula and Ballyshannon. However, he maintained in his autobiography that there were lingering elements of sectarianism in his relatives.
An extraordinary example of the enduring nature of sectarianism was to be found in my maternal grandmother. She was a lovely woman, but was very much of her time and tribe. Later in life, she had Alzheimer's, but one day, as I visited her at her sickbed, she had a startling moment of lucidity. As I patted her hand, she suddenly grabbed mine, opened her eyes wide, and said, "Whatever else you do, son, never marry a Catholic." Everything else had disappeared from her mind, but left at the bottom was the residue of sectarian aversion.
I think he perhaps in his autobiography, you know, he condemns the sectarianism that exists within the Protestant community in Donegal. I think that's probably, you know, over-egging it. He seems to draw upon his, when his grandmother was quite elderly and living in Scotland, she was originally called Sarah Lipset. She married George Corscadden. She lived for a very long time. She seems to have had some sectarian opinions at the end of her life, which sort of seems to have really stuck with Blair. And I think, understandably, a lot of people in Donegal believe that there has been a great tradition of Donegal liberalism among the Protestant community there, a great tolerance and a great neighbourliness. And I think there is, you know, a lot of truth in that.
My mother was from Donegal. Though living in the south, her family were Protestant farmers. Her father had been a Grand Master of one of the Orange Lodges. Ireland was not just in my blood, but part of my experience growing up. We had friends there we saw every year. Then in 1969, we suddenly stopped going. It was not safe, Mum decided. The troubles had begun. I kept in correspondence with the friends, and their letters told me of how the bitterness was entering the stream of public sentiment. They were Protestant, of course. They described with increasing venom the gradual deterioration of their relations with, and then their view of, their Catholic neighbours.
I think Blair is genuinely, you know, he says in his own autobiography, he's generally shocked by some of the poison that comes back into politics in Donegal in the early 1970s. And that he includes that among his, you know, his relatives in Donegal, that there is this kind of sharp mistrust that creeps back in. And he talks a lot about his summer holidays in Ballyshannon. He talks about his Carrignohorna, you know, loyalist background. And indeed, you know, there's no doubt that the Corscaddens, his mother's family, his grandfather was George Corscadden. You know, they were literally built Carrignohorna, Orange Hall, with their own hands. They are, to some extent, kind of Orange royalty in South Donegal.
Ultimately, Edward feels that Donegal's progressive unionism helped Blair understand that compromise would always be possible between both traditions in Northern Ireland.
I think Blair's appreciation of a place like Donegal and its complexity, I think, does put him in good stead compared to other British prime ministers to attempt to negotiate what ultimately becomes, of course, the Good Friday Agreement. So it's an important card which Blair is certainly, you know, is willing to play when it comes to talking to the DUP, that he understands their heritage. It influences him a lot in terms of, I think, giving him an understanding of the complexity and also perhaps some of the sectarianism that had blighted even, you know, Donegal as well, which is noted for its friendliness and generally neighbourly relations, you know, almost most of the time, with sort of these exceptional moments of great tension, whether it's the early 1920s or the late 1960s, early 1970s, there are moments of great tension. I think he learns a lot from that.
That was Mark McMenamin reporting there. He was speaking to Edward Burke about an arms raid in South Donegal in 1920 and the unexpected way it connects to the family history of Tony Blair. I'm joined now by Robert Love, a local historian from Donegal with a special research interest in the politics of Donegal's minority community. He's a history graduate from the University of Ulster, where his BA thesis explored the origins of cross-community conflict in County Donegal. You're very welcome indeed to the History Show, Robert.
Thank you.
So start, if you would, by painting a picture for us of the religious and political dynamic in County Donegal during the revolutionary period.
Okay, so religion, culture and politics all hugely intermixed at that period. Basically, in Ulster, your religion was your politics. And in Donegal, there were 35,000 non-Catholics, Protestants, and they represented 22% of the population. So they were quite a big proportion. That compared with the other Ulster counties that became part of the Free State and the Irish Republic, Monaghan would have been 25%, slightly higher, and Cavan 18%. What was interesting about Donegal is that they were highly concentrated geographically. They were concentrated in the east of the county, where the land was a lot better. And really, in areas there, they may have made up 70-80% of the population in quite large pockets. In south and west Donegal, they were concentrated between Killybegs, Donegal Town and Ballyshannon, just running around in the Drumlin Belt there, running around in southwest Donegal. They voted unionist. There was a first past the post electoral system in Ireland at that time. It did subsequently change in the 1920s, and they didn't have the numbers to elect an MP. But they were very, very strong unionists, and there were Orange Order lodges, many in that area, possibly as many as 10 within 15 miles of Tony Blair's relatives' farm. So, you know, it was very much like maybe parts of Fermanagh and parts of Tyrone.
And these were people who would have signed the Solemn League and Covenant, and many of them would have been members of the Ulster Volunteer Force.
Absolutely true. The Solemn League and Covenant was signed by 18,000 men and women in Donegal, which is
a huge percentage.
Well, they estimate that it's 70% plus of the eligible population. So, you know, you have to be careful about talking about, you know, how people voted on the basis of their religion. But I think we can say that most Protestants, the vast majority in Donegal at that period, were strongly unionist and strongly loyalist. And in terms of the UVF, there were three battalions in Donegal, 51 companies, 3,360 members. And when Edward Carston visited the Donegal UVF in Raphoe in 1913, 10,000 people came to that town and he inspected 2,600 armed men.
And did they benefit from the arms that had come in from Germany? And is that what the raid on the house of James Corscadden was all about?
Well, I think, you know, UVF arms in Donegal is a very, very interesting thing, because up until relatively recently, many people would have thought that the arms came in to Donegal from the SS Clyde Valley, which was Fred Crawford's famous gun-running expedition. And there are photographs of members of the Donegal UVF in Larne taking those guns. But in fact, a gentleman named Charles Clements, who was the 5th Earl of Leitrim and who was the officer commanding of the Donegal UVF, he had a steamship called the SS Gane Mór. And alongside his chauffeur and some people who worked on his estate, they actually smuggled rifles in from Scotland and ammunition, .303 ammunition. So actually the Donegal UVF, whether the IRA knew
it or not...
So Donegal
had its own gun running.
Donegal had its own gun running. They brought the ship into Derry. The guns were packed in furniture crates and steel cylinders marked filters and in drums of pitch and drums of petrol for the ammunition. So the local UVF were very well armed. Now, the question is, you know, did the IRA in the locality know that they were that well armed? And I think they would have presumed that they had as many arms as the UVF had across the rest of Ulster. They may not have known that they had, that they were quite as well armed.
But there were a lot of people who were targeted. I mean, in your own extended family, I think there were people who were targeted.
Well, I think, you know, I think it was Michael Collins who issued the order to seize arms where they could. And I think, you know, the UVF, they went into abeyance with the First World War. And, you know, there's a lot of debate over whether the UVF were actually any sort of an organisation in 1919, 1920, 1921, after the war was over. But certainly those guns were still there somewhere. Local community knowledge would tell you that they were in caches and that they were hidden in Orange Halls. They were hidden in Protestant schools. They were hidden, some were found in churches many, many decades and decades later, long after the people who'd put them away had expired.
And I think in the case of your, what was it, great-grandfather, he was politely asked by the IRA to hand over a weapon?
That's right. Well, actually, where I live, people don't talk that openly about these things, even 100 years on. Where I live, there are a number of houses, you know, within a quarter of a mile of the house. And I know for sure that two of those houses, the IRA called, masked men called, exactly the same situation as with Corscadden's in Carrick-na-Harner, masked men called. And there were two different outcomes. So to my relative, which would actually be my granny's father, the house that she grew up in, they called. And I only found this out in recent months. A cousin of my father's told me. My father had no idea. Nobody had ever told him about it. They called and they asked for the gun in the house. Now, whether that was a UVF gun or not, I'm not where, whether he was in the UVF or not, but I'd say he probably was. In our area, there was 130 people in the local UVF, and that was one of the largest in South Donegal. So I'm presuming that practically everybody who lived there that was eligible, so to speak, were in it. But it was the shotgun that they were looking for in the house. And so they came to the door and they asked him for the gun. And I'm told that he refused, and they pretty much forced their way into the house. And what was interesting, my father's cousin told me, was that they knew exactly where the gun was in the house. They walked across the living room and they went to the dresser and they put their hands up on the dresser and took that gun. And the reason they did that was because the family had tried to give them an old gun.
They tried to palm off some rusty old handgun.
A rusty old shotgun and so on. Shotgun, but they knew what they knew what they came for, and they took it.
But the IRA were quite polite because it was returned subsequently, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, that happened in the other case. The house next door, and in that instance, a bit like the Corscaddens, the family really didn't want to hand over the gun, and there was a number of sons in the house, and one of the sons actually went upstairs and shot the gun off through a skylight in an upstairs window. And what happened was the matriarch of the house, you know, fearing that there could be bloodshed, you know, begged her sons to hand the gun over, and they refused. And so the IRA said that they would come back, but that the gun would need to be handed over. And they did come back, and the gun was handed over, and there was no bloodshed. But one of the sons, and I'm not quite sure how long later this was, but it certainly was decades and decades later, was at a mart in Donegal town, and he was approached by a local man, a neighbour who lived maybe 2.5 miles away, who was well known to him. And he said, "Oh, I think I saw something in the ditch near your house." And he said, "Well, I don't think so. I was only there earlier this morning and it wasn't there." Now he says, "Oh no, I saw it. You need to check it." And when he got home from the mart, he went up the road and he went to the ditch, and there in the ditch, wrapped up in a waterproof casing, was the gun that had been taken many, many years before.
Incredibly polite. And I mean, does that speak to relations between the communities, between the two communities in Donegal? I mean, you would expect, you know, the UVF, the IRA, they would be daggers drawn. Was that necessarily the case?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about Donegal, and I think Ed talked about it in Mark's report earlier, is that, you know, community relations have invariably been very good. And, you know, I think that may be the case across the rest of the Ulster counties. It's only at times when politics become very hot that community relations get strained. Interestingly, when the County Donegal division of the UVF, the East Donegal UVF, got together in Stranorlar to head off to the Great War, the Band of the Irish Volunteers led them down through Stranorlar to the train station at the bottom of the town. And they played party songs of both traditions and gave three cheers for each other as they left. So, you know, I think these were people who lived side by side. Their communities were highly mixed. I think, you know, 99% of the time they got on well. But, you know, that was a very contested period, the revolutionary period. And I think that things reached a crescendo there that maybe never was before.
And that musical interlude that you're talking about is reciprocated in the St. Patrick's Day parade in Donegal town, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I think one of the bands from who associated with an Orange Lodge in Donegal town now leads the regularly the parade there, St. Patrick's Day.
And what about the notion of the Protestant exodus after the Free State is established from the border counties in particular?
Well, I think that's an absolute fact. You know, the drop in population in the Protestant community in Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal has been, you know, seismic. It's 50% in a century. And what's interesting to, if you look at the various censuses, is that, you know, the Protestant population of Donegal in particular had been slowly reducing since the middle of the 1800s. But between 1911 and the mid-1930s, it really went off a cliff. It dropped by half in those 15 years. So I think, you know, a lot of historians have wondered why that was. You know, I think, you know, in any community you have, like, these people were loyalists. They were loyalists still within the British Commonwealth and within the British Empire. But, you know, they'd spent maybe two decades resisting home rule. And what had actually happened is that their co-religionists in the other six counties of Ulster had actually cast them adrift. And so I think, you know, you might think that you wouldn't go back to that tribe if that had occurred. But I think really the new regime in Dublin, the Sinn Féin led government, I just think many of them thought this is not for us.
Interestingly, because, I mean, you talk about casting adrift. Obviously, Catholics in the six counties of Ulster would have felt that they had been cast adrift. But there wasn't anything like the same movement from that community into what became the Irish Free State, was there?
Yeah, that's true. I think, you know, probably in numbers terms, you have to remember that Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal had by far the lowest numbers of Protestants. Therefore, their communities were the smallest, you know. And I think, you know, you had a government there that that was a Sinn Féin government. And I'd say they probably feared for equity and other things. And, you know, and they'd spent 20 years predicting that Rome rule would follow home rule. And maybe they decided that they didn't want to hang around and see if that was the case.
Yet there was a tradition of independent Protestant TDs in the border areas. What did independent mean in that case, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's it's a really interesting part of Irish history that hasn't really been looked at. You know, the key change there was that first past the post was abolished by, it's one of the last things that the British government did before they left the 26 counties of Ireland. And they abolished first past the post and brought in proportional representation, which we still have. And that meant that in areas of Donegal, Cavan and Monaghan, where Protestants were, you know, in or around 20% of the population, there was a very good chance that they would...
With
multi-seat constituencies.
If you had four seats,
absolutely.
20% is going to get
absolutely.
You elected.
Absolutely. And in 1921 in Donegal, a chap called Robert Moore, who had been the local unionist candidate and failed in first past the post, he was absolutely in pole position to get elected. In fact, it was widely predicted that unionists would win their first seat in Donegal, you know, for many people's lifetimes with an expanded electorate. And actually, he didn't run. And he said he didn't run because there was intimidation at that time. And 1921 was a particularly heightened time in Donegal. But subsequently, in 1923, a chap called James Sproul Miles, he was a member, he was officer commanding in the local UVF. He was from Ballyshannon, which was very close to where the Corscaddens and Tony Blair's relatives were from. He ran as an independent candidate, topped the poll in every election that he stood in between 1923 and 1937. You know, he'd signed Ulster Solemn League and Covenant. He was in the UVF. He'd fought at the Somme. He'd won the Military Cross.
Fought against Rome Rule and
he fought
rule.
Against Home Rule, the whole thing.
And ends up in Dáil Éireann.
And ends up in Dáil Éireann. Because, you know, you face a stark choice, don't you? You know, you either, if politics turn out like you hope it doesn't, you still either you sit there and let it pass you by or you become an active participant. And actually that happened in Cavan. John Cole in Cavan, former UVF commander, signed the Ulster Solemn League and Covenant. And it's the irony is rich, isn't it, really, that men who signed a covenant to say that they would never accept a Dublin Parliament entered a Dublin Parliament. And the interesting thing about Miles was that actually he'd been kidnapped by the IRA and held for a period of time. That was in response to a hunger strike that was ongoing in Belfast, and they were held for a time as a bargaining chip to release the hunger strikers.
And final question, with these candidates, these independent candidates standing for election, obviously they would have got sufficient first preferences and presumably a few transfers to get them elected. Their voters, who did they tend to go for on the, for as their number two or number three choices?
Well, you know, there's a new book out by a chap called Samuel Beckton. It's called The History of the Protestant Associations of Counties Cavan, Donegal and Monaghan. And I would recommend it to anybody who's interested in this sort of unreported history, Irish history. And what he has done for the first time is really look at not just, you know, the four TDs who are elected, but he's looked at the significant numbers of urban district councillors and county councillors who were elected. And like in Donegal, there was at one stage perhaps as many as eight ex-unionist councillors. And transfers, their electorate transferred to nobody and none of the majority population transferred to
them.
They
were plumpers.
They were just plumpers. They were empire loyalists up until Ireland left the Commonwealth, and afterwards they were independent Protestant candidates. And basically, if you weren't a Protestant, you didn't vote for them. And if you weren't a Protestant, you didn't transfer for them. And they tended not to vote for anybody else.
It's a fascinating hidden history. Thank you very much for coming and for following up on Mark's equally fascinating report there. My guest is local historian Robert Love. Many thanks indeed for joining us, Robert. And after the break, we'll be hearing about the life and career of an agricultural innovator, Harry Ferguson. Stay with us. Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. Now we're going to look at the life of a pioneering figure in agricultural engineering. Harry Ferguson was an Irish mechanic and inventor who's noted for his role in the development of the modern agricultural tractor. A new book called Harry Ferguson, From Birth to the Black Tractor, explores his life and career. The author is John Barron, who's a collector of Ferguson and Massey Ferguson machinery and implements. He's had a lifelong fascination with Harry Ferguson's engineering genius and a personal passion for preserving agricultural history. Our reporter, Colm Flynn, visited John Barron at his home in Barefield, County Clare, to find out more about his research into Harry Ferguson's life.
I grew up on a small farm in County Carlow. At that time, the vast majority of farmers in the area where I was had Ferguson tractors. So from the word go, I was always interested in tractors.
So for you, it was just as a young lad on the farm, looking and admiring the machine with the name Ferguson on the side of it.
Well, yes, a little bit more than admiring, because as I grew a bit older, I learned to drive on a Ferguson tractor, as did a lot of my contemporaries. And then I started doing a bit of work, helping out on the family farm, and we use Ferguson tractors for that.
As the years went by, the Ferguson tractor became more than just a farm machine for John. It became a fascination, and not just with the tractor itself, but with the man behind it, Harry Ferguson.
He was born in 1884 near the town of Dromore, County Down, in Northern Ireland. He was born into a farming family. He was one of 11 siblings. He was the fourth oldest. Mixed type land, nothing spectacular in terms of quality of land. So he was born without privilege.
Now, there isn't a huge amount of detail about Ferguson's early childhood, but if we jump forward to 1902, we find him moving to Belfast to work for his older brother, Joe, who had set up a car and cycle repair business on the Shankill Road.
See, he hated farm work. He had left school in 1899. He'd worked until 1903 on his father's farm. He hated the work. He was very independent-minded. He was never going to be interested in repetitive work. And then he really came into his own when he started working for his brother. He's shown an immediate flair for mechanical things. He became very adept at tuning engines, which were very tricky at the time. He even patented a couple of ideas that he had relating to carburetors.
Near Banbridge Town in the County Down, one morning last July.
Bear in mind that when he entered the workforce in 1902, Northern Ireland was going through a golden age of innovation. It was the world leader in shipbuilding, the world leader in the production of linen, the world leader in the production of air conditioning. So there was a whole culture there of innovation. So that meant there was opportunity. It also meant that there was money.
He smiled at me and he says to me, "That's the gem in Ireland."
And it didn't take long for Harry Ferguson to stand out. He had a real flair for engineering and mechanics. But just as importantly, he had a gift for selling an idea. He understood publicity. He understood theatre. In many ways, he was a showman.
With me shoes shone bright and me hat cocked right.
He took up the sport of motorbike racing as a method of generating publicity for his brother's business.
As a young man, Ferguson was known for pulling daring stunts to attract attention and get free publicity. And one of the boldest came when he was just 25.
In 1908, he announced he was going to fly a plane. And nobody in Ireland had ever flown an airplane at that point. So in 1909, himself and a colleague called John Williams designed their own plane. And he was the first man in Ireland to fly a plane on the 31st of December 1909 at Hillsborough.
Do we know how long the flight lasted?
The flight lasted, I think, 30 seconds. It was about 130 yards in distance and something like somewhere between 15 and 20 feet from the ground. So he designed and built his own plane. So not only was he the first man in Ireland to fly a plane, but he was the second man in the British Isles to fly a plane of his own design and manufacture.
3 years later, in 1911, Ferguson decided to go out on his own and set up his own motor business. And by the time the First World War was underway, Ferguson had become the Irish dealer for an American-built tractor company called Overtime Tractors. He travelled around Ireland, demonstrating them at agricultural shows. And once again, his ability to put on a good demonstration got people's attention.
The demonstrations were so impressive. He was asked by the Department of Agriculture at the time, I think it was called the Board of Agriculture in Ireland, would he help farmers to grow extra cereal for the war effort, because Ireland was remitted to grow, I think, another 500,000 acres of cereal by the British government for the war effort. So Ferguson was asked to help farmers in the tillage areas of Ireland to achieve that. So he was appalled by the tractors, which were large, they were clunky, they were dangerous. And of course, the majority of farmers at the time on the smaller farms were using horse-drawn traction. So Ferguson then set out, really, to improve the plough, and over a period of time, up until 1933, he developed what was known as the Ferguson system. So the Ferguson system was where the implement and the tractor became one unit. So all the weight of the implement was put onto the tractor. So that meant that the tractor didn't have to be as heavy. So there was a saving in materials. It was safe because it couldn't rear up and injure the driver. And there were several other inventions then. It was all linked to what was known as a three-point system, the use of hydraulics, seven or eight different inventions, all worked into a system.
He had the idea, but he needed someone to build it. So Ferguson began shopping his invention around. He went from manufacturer to manufacturer. Some said no, some showed interest, but the deals fell apart. A few tractors were produced, but not in the numbers large enough to make it a commercial success. And, as so often happened in Ferguson's life, business relationships sometimes ended badly.
Yeah, he was very volatile and temperamental. He was charming. He could also be brash. He could be rude. He certainly was forthright in his views.
Then Ferguson took his idea to one of the biggest names in the automotive world, Henry Ford.
He went to Henry Ford in 1938, and they started a relationship whereby Ford would manufacture the tractor. Ferguson would be responsible for all design. He would be responsible for procuring and selling the implements, all of the marketing, all of the demonstrating, and all of that. So Henry Ford started producing the tractor called the Ford Ferguson tractor in 1939.
It was an ideal partnership. In 1938, Ferguson demonstrated his tractor system to Ford, and the two men struck what became famous as the Handshake Agreement. The result was the Ford Ferguson tractor, launched in 1939.
But you see, this new tractor was different than anything else that existed because it contained the Ferguson system, which was basically a transformational, disruptive technology. So there was nothing like this in the market. Henry Ford recognized that. He had the infrastructure and the factories and the technology to mass produce.
The Second World War and the years immediately after brought shortages, restrictions, and pressure on manufacturers. Steel was in short supply and companies were limited in what they could produce. But this is where Ferguson's nerve, his charisma, and marketing genius came into play again.
So he immediately went to President Roosevelt and did a demonstration on Roosevelt's farm in Hyde Park and convinced Roosevelt not only to release the steel, but also to buy a tractor and implement.
Did he buy it?
He did, yeah. He did. Yeah. Yeah.
For Harry Ferguson, it looked as though things couldn't get any better. But the whole arrangement depended heavily on Henry Ford himself. And in 1945, Henry Ford's grandson, Henry Ford II, took over the company and began making major changes. Then, in 1947, Henry Ford died, and the old handshake agreement began to unravel.
When Henry Ford II took the helm, he realised that the whole company was in a mess. And one of the areas that Henry Ford II identified as being in particular dire straits from a Ford point of view, not from Ferguson's point of view, because Ferguson was making money, but Ford wasn't making money from tractors. So he told Ferguson in 1946 that they weren't going to supply the tractors anymore.
It was a major blow for Harry, and the split nearly destroyed his business. But Ferguson wasn't done yet. He returned to Britain and began producing a new tractor, the Ferguson TE20, with a firm called the Standard Motor Company. It became famously known as the Little Grey Fergie, a small, reliable grey tractor that would become one of the most beloved machines in farming history.
The Ferguson TE20 tractor, or Little Grey Fergie, the machine that revolutionised farming.
Then, in 1953, Ferguson entered a partnership that would become part of tractor history.
When a farmer works the land today, he needs a machine or two. And they gotta be good to stand the test and do what they're supposed to do.
He was approached by a Canadian company called Massey Harris. They agreed, really an acquisition that Massey Harris, because they were a significantly bigger company. So they acquired Ferguson in 1953.
Creating the Massey Harris Ferguson tractor, which would later become known as Massey Ferguson.
Massey's number one.
With all this success in business, was he a very wealthy man? Was he happy? Was he satisfied?
No, he was considered, by people that contemporaries of his time, that he was so driven that he never really was contented with his lot. He did suffer during his life from what I suppose nowadays is called clinical depression. Although he had a vision, he was also very much focused on detail and was obsessional about detail and about his appearance and about the appearance of his estate. And generally, people that have written about his lifestyle at the time and his life in general would claim that he wasn't particularly happy.
What age was he when he passed away?
76.
Harry Ferguson died in 1960, leaving behind a machine that revolutionized farm machinery and also an incredible legacy.
Who are we?
Yes,
he developed a technology that was transformational, a disruptive technology, changed world agriculture. It's very important, I think, we remember him, maintain his legacy, so that hopefully there will be other Harry Fergusons in Ireland, North and South, in the future.
So stand up proud and say it loud.
We're Massey Ferguson.
Colin Flynn was reporting there. He was talking to John Barron about the life and career of mechanic, inventor and agricultural innovator Harry Ferguson. John Barron is the author of the new book, Harry Ferguson, From Birth to the Black Tractor. That's a 224-page hardback publication in coffee table format. It contains more than 350 images and much previously unpublished written and photographic material relating to all aspects of Ferguson's career up to 1939. You can get hold of a copy of the book at vintageferguson.com. And after the break, we'll hear from Susan McKenna-Lawler, who worked on the European Space Agency's Giotto mission to Halley's Comet in 1986. Welcome back to The History Show. 40 years ago, in 1986, one of the night sky's most famous visitors returned to the inner solar system. Halley's Comet had been watched, feared, and interpreted for centuries, but this time it was met not only by telescopes on Earth, but by multiple spacecraft sent to study it in great detail. Among them was Giotto, launched by the European Space Agency. Irish science had a place on board through an instrument developed by Professor Susan McKenna-Lawler and her team. In this report, Ian Kennelly and journalist Flo McCarthy travel to Dunboyne, County Meath, to meet Professor McKenna-Lawler, whose connection with Halley's Comet began long before Giotto's journey into space.
I was very interested in the comet. I was taken by the fact that my grandmother had seen it, and my mother. They had that story of going out in Cork and looking up at the sky, and my grandmother was worried to have this baleful presence over her land. And then when I brought my mother to see Halley's Comet, and she said, "Oh, my beautiful Comet, where have you been and what have you seen since we last met?" And she treated it like an old friend.
That's wonderful. You know, Douglas Hyde's wife
was named after the Great Comet of 1861. She was German. So her name is Lucy Cometina Kurtz.
Lovely. I didn't know that. Oh, you must write that down for me.
I will.
Because I'm writing a book at the present time.
That book will recount Professor McKenna Lawler's career in science. And what an incredible career it has been. Born in Dublin, she studied in UCD, choosing to pursue a general science degree, a choice that surprised her teachers and, indeed, her parents. The young Susan's abilities were quickly noticed, although, as she tells Flor, the manner in which she began her career as an astrophysicist was somewhat unusual.
As a girl leaving school, I had learned poetry, I had learned to play the cello, I could play the piano, but not a word of science had crossed my desk. I just didn't know about science.
And so where did your interest in science come from?
Well, it came in a peculiar way. I was doing a master's degree at UCD, University College Dublin, and I was pushing the finishing touches to my thesis. I was alone in the room, and the door flew open, and the dean of experimental physics came in, and he said, "I have just recommended that you have a scholarship to the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies. Will you take it?" And I was thunderstruck. And I said, "But Professor, I know nothing about astronomy. Do you think that's a good idea?" And he said, "Of course it's a good idea. I've thought of it. Now will you take it? People are waiting." And that was the beginning of my career in astronomy.
McKenna Lawler's early research was on solar activity, including flares, which she carried out in Dunsink Observatory during the late 1950s and early 1960s, and subsequently at the University of Michigan. After returning to Ireland, she accepted a post in St. Patrick's College in what is now Maynooth University, where she lectured in the experimental physics department, while also working on space programs such as NASA's Skylab and its Solar Maximum mission. It was during this period that she learned of the European Space Agency's plans to intercept and study Halley's Comet.
You see, one of the things, a comet is very ancient. The material of which it's made goes right back to prehistoric times. And there was a hope that by studying what the comet was made of, they could find out what the solar system was made of. So it was very exciting.
McKenna Lawler met first with Rüdiger Reinhard, a German who was a project scientist and coordinator for GIATO. Through him, she then met Ian Axford, a director in Germany's Max Planck Institute for Solar System Research, which was playing a leading role in the mission.
And so he said to me, "Would you like to be the PI for the Irish experiment?" That, of course, was a very dazzling thing to say to someone like me, who had no experience with space instruments. And I said that I was very willing to do all the work that would be required of a principal investigator.
McKenna Lawler led a team of Irish scientists and engineers. Dennis O'Sullivan and Alex Thompson would be key to analysing results from the Irish experiment. Michael Martin designed and developed the experiment's electronics and mechanics, while Brendan Jordan designed some of its information processing electronics. McKenna Lawler named the experiment EPONA, both an acronym for Energetic Particle Onset Admonitor, and a name which recalled a goddess once worshipped across Celtic and Roman Europe. It was an experiment that built upon her previous research into solar activity.
I had a look at what they were flying already, and I said I had noted that there was no high-energy particle experiment, and that I thought that this would be very suitable, that we could study the ions which had been accelerated, and that also it would be very useful if there had been a flare on the sun, that the particles of the sun and of the comet would be mixed.
The Giotto mission was a great success. Launched in July 1985 from French Guiana, the craft made its closest approach to Halley's Comet in March 1986, providing reams of data and the first direct image of a comet's nucleus. Epona played its part, producing data on how energetic particles were generated as the solar wind interacted with the plasma surrounding the comet. Indeed, so successful was the Giotto mission that it was prolonged to include a close approach to a second comet, 26P Grigg Skellerup, 6 years later. Aside from Giotto, this was a remarkably prolific time in McKenna Lawler's career. During this period, she set up Space Technology Ireland Limited. The company was a forerunner in what today is Ireland's increasingly dynamic space technology industry.
I thought that it was very important for Ireland to use the prestige I had gained for getting into the space business. And when I came back from the Giotto mission the first time, I said that Ireland should now establish a space agency. And I thought that there would be a lot of very important jobs which would be available to Irish students if they were properly trained.
McKenna Lawler and Space Technology Ireland contributed to missions for space agencies across the globe, not only in Europe and the USA, but also in China, Japan and India. Perhaps the most famous are the ESA's Mars Express and its later Rosetta mission, which landed a craft on the surface of Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko in 2014. To this day, Professor Susan McKenna Lawler retains her love of discovery, and she remains deeply committed to the further development of Irish science.
That was Ian Kennelly and Flor McCarthy reporting from Dunboyne, County Meath, where they met Professor Susan McKenna Lawler, an astrophysicist and a leading contributor to the European Space Agency's Giotto mission to Halley's Comet in 1986. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. My thanks tonight to Niall McMonagall and Mark McGrath on sound, and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.